I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media. Hey everybody, it's AG and welcome to Refried Beans, where we play an episode of the Daily Beans podcast from the same week, either 1, 2, or 3 years ago, so we can see how far we've come. So please enjoy this episode from days gone by and note the date in the intro.
Refried beans. I like refried beans. That's why I want to try fried beans, because maybe they're just as good and we're wasting time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Beans for Friday, April 10th. Today, Matt Gaetz looks to be in even more trouble as Joel Greenberg is likely taking a plea deal. The case against the Trump Organization in Manhattan gets stronger as more financial records are handed over from the Weiselbergs. More people are getting voting rights back in the state of Washington, and Ted Cruz looks like he's even in more trouble, this time over his book. Sitting in for AG today, I'm Dana Goldberg, and joining me is no one other than Mary Trump. Mary, oh my goodness. First of all, I want to thank you for joining me. I know you're in a secluded location. You're never supposed to read the news. I know this about you, and you still said yes. How are you?
I'm okay. I guess under the circumstances, I'm really happy to be here. And honestly, AG couldn't have picked a better day to take off since it's been such a slow news day. So, you know, we can just hang out.
Yeah, I got nothing. Let's just share some funny childhood quips, shall we?
Sure.
Hey, how is your book coming along? I know that you are literally, as I said, in an undisclosed location trying to finish this damn thing. How is it going, honestly?
I'm guessing my editor put you up to that question. It's going. I've got my blinders on and my head down. You know, honestly, being vaccinated, even though I'm not even going outside, is a huge relief.
Yes.
To have that out of the way. It really takes, as you know, it just takes a huge load off. And I'm just going to get this thing done and hopefully it will be good.
Well, I know that everyone listening, including the patrons that were part of the original book club for Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, are just waiting, biting at the bit for this to come out. So I can't wait. I know you're shooting for July to have it finished. Is that still the final date?
No, I'm. It's getting published in July, which is a kind of a different thing.
Oh, shit. You've got to be done way sooner than that.
Much sooner, and not June or May.
Okay. So got it. All right. So let's rip through this. AG, thank you so much for trusting me with your baby for a day. I'm glad Mary can join us. Everyone, please remember to join AG and Andrew Torres live in their stereo app this coming Tuesday at 5 p.m. And then AG is going to be back with me live on Thursday, as always, at 5 p.m. So I hope that you'll join us for that. Please join the stereo app if you're not already on there. And later in the show, AG has a great interview with Sam Goldman. She is the host of Refuse Fascism podcast. So you'll be able to listen to that. AG, thank you for recording before you took some much needed time off. So that'll come later in the show. But right now, we have a lot of headlines to cover. So let's do it, Mary. Let's hit the hot notes.
Hot notes.
All right, everyone. So the lead story comes from Politico today. Now, the legal peril Matt Gaetz is facing appears to be increasingly getting worse. As of Thursday, after a court hearing indicated that one of Gaetz's close friends, the former Seminole County, Florida tax collector, we know this great human being, Joel Greenberg, he's actually very likely cooperating with federal prosecutors, Mary. So shit's about to go down. Now, this development for close ally as the form of the former guy came as prosecutors and defense attorney for Greenberg appeared before a judge here to discuss the next steps in a recent expanded criminal case charging Greenberg with sex trafficking of a minor, as well as stalking, bribery, and defrauding the pandemic-related Paycheck Protection Program. I don't know if you remember that, but he did not spend the money the way he was supposed to. Shocking. I know. So this is actually a quote. I am sure Matt Gaetz is not feeling very comfortable today, said Greenberg's defense attorney, Fritz Scheller. And this was after the hearing.
But just as supportive as Donald has been of Matt Gaetz.
I know. He's like, yeah, I never know him. Maybe he just brought me coffee once. So the federal probe looking into whether Gaetz had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and paid for her travel, that began last year and grew. This grew out of the Greenberg investigation. So he's already in hot water for this. So they said, we believe the case is going to be a plea. Now, that's the federal prosecutor, Roger Hanberg. That's what he said at the outset of the brief hearing. It was very, very short. He also continued to say, my hope would be that it's done this month. Now, Scheller agreed that his client is looking to make a deal. He said, I expect this case to be resolved with a plea. And that's what the defense lawyer. He said moments later. Now, the briefing, this thing only took 10 minutes. Attorneys did not actually mention Gaetz by name, but the exchange, however, strongly suggested that Greenberg's likely assisting the prosecution. Fabulous. Yes. So the new development signals potentially serious trouble for Matt, like he's not enough as it is, as prosecutors now have someone very close to the congressman, apparently willing to provide an insider account of his activities, such as information and perspective that can be vital to provide context for the financial travel records prosecutors are known to be scrutinizing. So speaking to reporters after the court session, Scheller remained cagey, as they said, about whether his client had provided information specifically about Gaetz to federal prosecutors. But the defense lawyer said Greenberg about him that he's uniquely positioned. That's what he said about him. Yeah, uniquely. So Scheller, also the plea talks with the government were underway before the latest indictment against Greenberg was filed last month. So this has been going on for a while. And those that those new charges that came are actually what they say is no surprise to him or his clients. So Matt Gaetz is going down. It's a matter of time before this happens. This guy's flipping on him. He's supposed to be a good friend. It does not look good. Politico actually reported Tuesday that friends of the men say Greenberg introduced Gaetz to Greenberg, found through profiles on websites like Seeking Arrangement, which features women looking for sugar daddy relationships with wealthy men. And Matt actually sent a text, Mary, a text to Politico saying, I've never paid for sex. He sent a text saying that to Politico.
That's pathetic.
And well, I also don't buy it because there's no way anyone has had sex with Matt Gaetz without being paid.
Not voluntarily, no.
Oh, exactly, or having drugs involved. Now, while details of Greenberg's potential deal with prosecutors were not spelled out in court, such agreements typically require cooperation with the government and a promise to provide testimony against other potential defendants. Now, in exchange, prosecutors would likely drop many of the 33 felony charges leveled against the former tax collector in a superseding indictment handed up last week. So such a move would reduce the maximum prison time, of course, for Greenberg. But in addition, his sentencing would likely be put off until after his cooperation and potential testimony against others is complete. That could mean it's more than just Matt Gaetz.
That is quite a story. And it included two of AG's favorite words, superseding indictment.
There you go. The former guy is apparently getting into more hot water. You've got news from New York now.
I do. This is feeling like an extended version of Schadenfreude. From the Washington Post, investigators from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, acting on a grand jury subpoena, took possession of financial records Thursday morning from the apartment of Jennifer Weisselberg, the former daughter-in-law of a top Trump Organization officer who's worked for my grandfather since 1971. So I'm guessing there might be some really interesting information here. Jennifer Weisselberg was married to Barry Weisselberg, the son of Trump Organization chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg. She's previously said that she had 7 boxes of financial records from both her ex-husband and his father, some of which were obtained through divorce litigation. Oops. On Thursday, she loaded 3 boxes and a laptop computer into a Jeep that was waiting outside her building. Oh, the intrigue.
And if anyone knows about loading boxes of financial records into cars parked outside buildings, it's you.
I am having flashbacks. Seriously, I have chills. This is so cool. Oh my God, the symmetry. The move by District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. appears to be the latest sign that Alan Weisselberg, the company's highest ranking corporate officer, who's not a member of the family, Trump's family, Donald Trump's family, is a key focus of the ongoing criminal probe into the former guy. Sorry, can't say that word.
No, I appreciate it. That's what we do here.
Donald John Trump's financial dealings. The subpoena, a copy of which was obtained by the Washington Post, ordered Jennifer Weisselberg to produce all of the records she possesses for her ex-husband's bank accounts and credit cards, plus his statements of net worth and tax filings. Barry Weisselberg is a Trump Organization employee and manages an ice rink for the company in Manhattan Central Park. The subpoena asked specifically for records related to the Trump Organization and Woolman Rink. Quote, my knowledge of the documents and my voice connect the flow of money from various banks and from personal finances that bleed directly into the Trump Organization, Jennifer Weisselberg said in an interview Thursday. Investigators, she added, now have her ex-husband's 2019 and 2020 statements of net worth, his tax returns, and copies of Woolman Rink checks from private events that she claims were deposited incorrectly. I'm shocked.
Nothing like a woman scorned, I tell you right now.
Brilliant. Vance and New York Attorney General Letitia James, speaking of amazing women, running parallel investigations, have inquired about whether Alan Weisselberg or his son received untaxed benefits from the Trump Organization. Jennifer Weisselberg has previously said, for example, that her family received free use of Trump Organization apartments in Manhattan. Experts say that in some instances, free housing must be counted as income for tax purposes. Jennifer Weisselberg has said it was not in this case. Investigators are examining whether the values of certain properties in the Trump Organization's portfolio were manipulated to gain tax advantages or favorable loans and insurance rates under false pretenses. In complex investigations like those into Donald's business activities, prosecutors routinely seek evidence of wrongdoing by subordinates as a means to elicit their cooperation and expose damaging information about their bosses. The pressure facing Alan Weisselberg appears intended to pursue that strategy against Donald, although neither Vance nor James has alleged wrongdoing by Donald or Weisselberg or anyone else. Not yet. A person with knowledge of the district attorney's investigations previously told the Post that, indeed, Vance is working to flip him. How about that?
I love it. I'm sure you love seeing this, too. The more ammo they get on the Trump Organization, the better. Just switching directions a little bit, there's been so much voter suppression from a lot of the other states. This is not the case up in Washington. Governor Jay Inslee on Wednesday signed a bill automatically restoring voting rights to people who have been released from prison after committing felonies, even if they are still on parole. And that measure was sponsored by a lawmaker who was formerly incarcerated. Now, this is a quote, while other states are restricting the right to vote, I'm glad that in Washington, we are expanding access to democracy, Inslee said. Now, Rep. Tara Simmons was convicted of assault in 2001 and of a drug and theft charges in 2011. It was after her father's death sent her into a battle with methamphetamines. I love this. She went to law school, Mary. She won approval from the state Supreme Court to take the bar exam following her release. Last November, she became apparently the first former felon elected to the legislature in the state of Washington.
Wow.
Amazing. She and other supporters said the measure would help encourage former prisoners to reintegrate into society. It was just a matter of racial justice, as they put it. Those on parole in Washington are disproportionately people of color. More than 20,000 people stand to regain their voting rights when the law takes effect next year. And a quote, regaining the right to vote after having lost so many things meant more to me than most people could imagine, Simmons, a Democrat from Bremerton, said in news release Wednesday. She went on to say, this might seem a small thing to some people. It's a giant step for civil rights, and it's one that gives others What it gave me, a belief that I mattered, that I was once again a member of society, and that my freedom was worth preserving at all cost. Inslee thanked Simmons for her work on the bill. He said, as a person who has rebuilt her life following her incarceration, she has so successfully and effectively used her lived experience to benefit of others and to our community. Now, state Republicans shockingly opposed the measure, despite support from many quarters, including the state attorney general's office, the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, some victims rights advocates, and Republican Rep. Jesse Young, who actually co-sponsored this bill, Mary. So Republican senators said former prisoners, this is what they're saying, should complete their sentences, including parole, and show that they can follow the law before they regain the right to vote, which is pretty fucking rich considering how many Republicans these days can't actually even follow the law themselves, including this next guy that you've got the story on.
Would that be Ted Cancun Cruz, perhaps?
That would be Ted Cancun Cruz. He's back in the United States breaking more laws.
Sadly, he's back in the United States, but thankfully, he's getting caught for breaking law this time. It looks like a nonpartisan government watchdog group on Wednesday filed complaints with the Federal Election Commission and the Senate Ethics Committee, accusing Senator Ted Cruz of using campaign funds to generate profits from a book he wrote in 2020. Fascinating that the book sold. The Campaign Legal Center claims that Cruz improperly used donations to his campaign committee to spend $18,000 on Facebook ads promoting One Vote Away, How a Single Supreme Court Seat Can Change History. The book was intended to highlight Cruz's conservative legal philosophy, but also provided him with a hefty $400,000 advance and 15% of the royalties on sales, according to his 2019 Senate financial disclosure forms. When elected officials use campaign contributions to advance their personal bottom lines, they compromise the integrity of the political process, the group wrote in a letter to the Ethics Committee. Such cases seldom result in serious penalties. And Dana, that's one of the problems. The FEC is pretty toothless, I think, right?
Absolutely.
The FEC has often negotiated with candidates to repay their campaigns for questionable expenses, while the Ethics Committee has been reluctant to take action on all but the gravest violations. The fact that Mr. Cruz profited from each sale of the book and the fact that his campaign paid for promotion of it triggered the complaint, said Brendan Fisher, the Campaign Legal Center's director of federal reform. This is a clear-cut case. There is a lot of precedent, he said in an interview. Federal campaign law is clear that campaigns are not for the personal use of a candidate and can't be used to promote the sale of a candidate's book for which they receive a royalty. Chris Gober, a letter representing the committee that paid for the ad, Ted Cruz for Senate, said Mr. Cruz denied the claims. Of course he did. Senator Cruz's campaign has closely followed Federal Election Commission laws and guidelines when promoting his book, and he has not received any royalties whatsoever from these book sales, probably because the book didn't sell.
Because it didn't sell.
Oh, well. That was a quote from Mr. Gober, forwarded by a Cruz spokeswoman. Mr. Fisher said that the claim that Cruz received no royalties is contradicted by Mr. Cruz's own set of disclosures, which provide a detailed royalty structure that gave him 15% of net sales and a lesser amount for each book sold at discount. The Facebook ad cited in the complaint directed buyers to purchase the books through links to three online retailers. It's not clear how those sales would not have generated royalties unless Mr. Cruz had devised a complex system to divert them to a special pool, he added. A spokeswoman for Mr. Cruz did not respond to requests to clarify Mr. Gober's statement or answer any of the questions raised by Mr. Fisher.
Shocking. And it's amazing how Republicans can't seem to sell their books without breaking the law, including, I don't know, the RNC buying how many copies of Junior's book? And I'm pretty sure you sold 1 million in 1 week without any help from any contributions or breaking any laws.
It was actually a day, but let's not quibble.
A day. 1 million in a day. Book sales that Cruz will never, ever see. All right, everyone. Now, AG was kind enough to give a great interview with Samantha Goldman. She's a host of Refuse Fascism. That's a podcast. And she did this interview before she took the much-deserved day off today. They're going to be discussing where we stand after 74 million people voted for more of Trump, where we stand after January 6th, after the removal of the Trump-Pence regime, and what it will really take to stem the tide of American fascism. So you don't want to miss this interview. It's fantastic. So just do me a favor, stick around. We'll be right back.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Yeah.
everybody, welcome back. Thank you, Dana and Mary, for hosting the show today while I take a day off. My guest today, she has been sounding the alarm on the rise of fascism and the fascist movement for more than 15 years now. Please welcome the host of the Refuse Fascism podcast, Sam Goldman. Sam, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Allison. I'm glad to be here.
I am really excited to talk to you. I've been doing the Nazi stomp since the late 80s, so I'm very excited to talk to you about this because I want to know, you've been doing this for a long time. I wanted to know, because you're almost on episode 50 now of your podcast, which is congratulations. That's so great.
Thank you.
And everyone, you can get the podcast Refuse Fascism wherever you get your podcasts. And I was interested in sort of where it started for you. What sort of started you sounding this alarm on the rise of fascism? Because it's global now. And what led to you wanting to start the podcast?
Yeah, so Refuse Fascism started right after Trump won. We were initiated basically on an emergency basis in the wake of the election. In our founding mission was that this regime represented a catastrophic danger, where people had to unite and organize to actually drive this regime from power. And we were calling for sustained day after day, you know, week after week, nonviolent mass protest. And with our central pledge was around stopping a regime that we were saying imperiled humanity, not just American lives, but people all over the globe and the earth itself. And our slogan was, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And our unifying demand was the Trump-Pence regime must go. And we were identifying that there was a identifiable, nameable program that was fascist, that Trump's Make America Great Again was a 21st century fascist program, complete with white supremacy, misogyny, and xenophobia. America first, wrapped in the flag, and Mike Pence's Bible taken literally. And we saw that there was a strengthening Christian fascist movement that formed its most organized base, and their hatred of science fused with Trump's pathological lying to really allow not just the seeds of conspiracy theories to be planted, but really for them to flourish. And that we were recognizing a real move for the destruction of truth and objective reality. And so we saw that as a danger from the beginning. And when we say fascism, we're not just talking about the baddest of insults that you can throw, but a qualitative change in how society is ruled. And once consolidated, you know, in a fascist society, you do not have any way to redress. You don't have the right to protest. You don't have a rule of law. All of that is eroded. You don't have civil rights. And that this is a form of rule that really is of brute terror and force. And it foments and relies upon, you know, as I mentioned before, this triad of xenophobia, misogyny, and white supremacy. And so we didn't start the podcast right away. We started this summer, the week that millions began to pour into the streets, rebelling against white supremacy, demanding justice for George Floyd, is actually the week that we started. And we noticed that the fascist regime was tightening its grip on society. And because COVID, we called the podcast Inside Without Now, since we were a movement that was demanding Trump Pence out now. And the regime was doubling down on its deadly COVID program and unleashing violence on those who dared to call out white supremacy, and was mobilizing their rabid anti-science base into the streets. And so, as you mentioned, we have had 50 episodes to really, we just aired episode 51. And our purpose is to really dig into where did this fascism come from? What do we mean by it? Now that these fascists are out of power, what danger still exists? And really challenging people to question whether we can truly move on if we don't confront this danger.
Right, because it's not over. Just because the former guy is out of office, we see echoes of that fascism everywhere still. And it's extremely dangerous, you know, that he went after the press, his attacks on our institutions. I mean, very common known steps toward fascism. And you know, you said you started the podcast on an emergency basis. We started Mueller, She Wrote, kind of on an emergency basis. We were thinking about it for a few months, and then all of a sudden indictments dropped, and we're like, well, the microphone, get in the kitchen, let's record. However, we were called crazy. We were told we were being alarmist, and that Russia was a hoax, and that everything we disagreed with must come from Russia. We were called Blue Anon, the Q of the left. I mean, we were attacked pretty fiercely by defenders of that administration. And I was wondering if you had that experience as well, especially being a woman.
Absolutely. We were, and we are, I'll clarify what I mean by that. Challenging people on two fronts. The biggest thing we got is we were using the word fascism. We were describing the danger. We were sounding the alarm. We were saying, if we don't act, humanity will be in peril. And we were definitely called alarmists. We were told that fascism couldn't happen here. Not in this country, the greatest of all countries. And we were also told that our institutions were so strong, our democracy was so strong, that we wouldn't succumb to fascism. We were also told the lie that people in this country couldn't stop fascism if it happened. We were told that all we could do, the best we could do, is root for the good guys. And it really did tremendous harm over the past 4 years, those who kept people off the streets, those who told people to only raise reasonable demands, those who told people that they could just
their votes didn't matter, or that they could just rely
on the elections and be quiet and sit back and wait for 4 years as children were put in cages, as Muslims were banned from entry, as, you know, you basically had a demented bully with his finger on the nuclear trigger threatening the world with fire and fury. And people were told that they needed to rely on the normal processes. And we saw how close we came to that being all for naught.
Yeah, we saw that on January 6th.
Yeah, we so narrowly escaped a crisis, you know. And this election, you know, thankfully there were people that came out and there were enough votes that this was defeated, but this was a showdown over nothing less than the rule of society, whether there was going to be fascism or there wasn't going to be. And the fact that, you know, one of our guests, Dr. Bandy Lee, psychologist, who came on very recently to our show on episode 40, you know, one of the things that she said was that because the removal was not a forced removal, and it wasn't really a reckoning of his whole presidency, but rather a continuation of enabling in many ways, we see a lot of the effects of Trumpism continuing.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring up that, you know, that whole it can't happen here idea. That's part of the package of fascism is to sort of sow apathy. Right. I mean, to convince you that that invincibility makes us a target for you know, authoritarian leaders. And, you know, just because we have defeated the former guy in November doesn't mean that the next one won't come back out of the woodwork. And then there's also the networks of dark money that still support all of it. So it's very much an alive and a very much a hot issue. And I think using, it's interesting when you say that people were why are you using the word fascism when that's not what this is? I think anyone who has studied history might have something else to say. And I know that you and I spoke briefly before we started recording here about Dr. Schneider's On Tyranny, which is a very important book, I think, Lessons, 20 Lessons from governments that have lost that battle. And I'm interested to know, you mentioned that you had Dr. Bandy on. Who are some of the other guests you've had on? What are some of the other discussions that you've had, relative to how to refuse fascism, not only refuse it, but, you know, be actively against it?
Yeah. So we've really been digging into, as I said, since January 6th, really understanding what did transpire. And also, looking back at these past 4 years, what does it mean that they're out of power? But what does it also mean that the forces that brought it to power still remain? That the soil that it grew from, the soil of a country founded on white supremacy and genocide, of a system that has no answer for global warming or the refugee crisis, that will continue to spit out fascists. We've been exploring that in a lot of depth, and I really encourage people to listen to our 50th episode. We really focused on learning from the past to chart the future, and we did so by bringing on Dr. Susan Neiman, who's the author of Learning from the Germans. And her book explores the working through period post the World War II, post the Nazis of Germany, and the history of slavery in the United States and the period after. And she had so much insight to bear on what the lessons of confronting the crimes that are committed in your name are, what it means to confront white supremacy, and what the consequences of failing to do so are.
Yeah, that's very big, because, we have a new show called Clean Up on Aisle 45, focusing on holding the Trump administration accountable, which oftentimes doesn't happen. Previous presidents don't hold previous presidents accountable for their crimes. And that I fully believe that led to this particular administration. And if we don't hold them accountable, very bad thing. That's a very bad precedent. Let's just say that it opens the door for future Howleys, for example, to step in. We were very lucky, I guess, in a way that this particular authoritarian regime was led by not a very smart person. But that might not be the case next time. And so that's why I think it's so very important that we learn those lessons. So that's, you said that interview is in episode 50?
Episode 50. And it's paired with an interview with Daryl Lamont Jenkins of the One People's Project, where we talk about the current state of the fascist movement. He is the top expert on the Proud Boys. And we talk about what it means that nearly 75 million people, knowing all that Trump is for, knowing the violent misogyny, the violent white supremacy, the whole package, the fact that hundreds of thousands of people died because of his criminal negligence, over COVID. Knowing all of that, they said more, please. And what the implications of that are. So that was in episode 50. I also really found episode 49. I had a conversation on the power of lies and the centrality of lies to fascism with fascism scholar Federico Finkelstein. He is the author of several books that I highly recommend, both on fascism, on populism. And he explores with me the fascist movement post-Trump, the impact of Trump on other fascist leaders, the need for accountability, and most importantly, why it matters that we identify this as fascism and why we look at the destruction of objective reality as a cornerstone of that full program. And we looked at what that means in terms of something like a global pandemic to have a fascist in power. And we also look at Bolsonaro in Brazil, who Federico does tremendous work on.
Wow. Yeah, because we couldn't have had a worse administration to deal with the pandemic. Wow. Yeah, I really encourage everybody to check out your podcast. It's called Refuse Fascism. You can get it wherever you find podcasts. And where can people follow you on Twitter?
Yeah. So I just want to say there's so many. We run the range of topics covering like Trump's refusal to wear a mask is a sign of fascism, to having experts like Jason Stanley talk about how fascism works, a lot on Trump's death cult, the Christian fascist movement and its embrace of Trump, American exceptionalism and American mythology. But we also talk to people on the front line of refusing this fascism, from Portland to LA to North Carolina to the suburbs of Chicago, the experience and unique insights of a Holocaust survivor, and we also get into organizing methods.
Great. Calls to action, very important, always.
Exactly. So it's like the full, I just want to let people know you'll hear from academics, but you'll also hear from activists, and you'll hear from artists and people of prominence like Rosie O'Donnell, Rosanna Arquette, and others. And you can find the podcast, as Allison said, wherever you listen to podcasts. But you can follow Refuse Fascism on Twitter at Refuse Fascism. You can follow me at Sam B. Goldman.
Awesome. I appreciate your time today. Everybody, seriously, check it out. I look forward to the next episode, too. I appreciate your time today. Sam Goldman, appreciate you.
Thanks so much, Allison.
Everybody, stick around. We'll be right back with good news.
All right, everyone, it's time for the good news.
Who likes good news? Everyone? Then good news, everyone!
Good news, good news.
Now, Mary, I love this part of the show because you get to see a lot of pod pets. We get to see good news. We've got confessions, corrections. We've been playing a game called Guess That Mutt, which is AG and I are terrible at. I don't know if you've been listening to the podcast, but we're really, really bad.
I have. And I'm going to make you guys look good, probably.
Oh, I don't know about that. So hopefully we've got some good stories. If you've got good news, corrections, and confessions, continue to send them into the podcast. We'd love to have them. I'm going to get this started. It's a short one. So actually, you know what? I'll take the first two. They're very short. First one's from Jim, pronouns he and him. Dana, here are some hummingbird photos from the swarm we feed each year in Indiana. The good news is that they've been sighted in Indiana. So we'll be hanging out the feeders soon. I love this. I actually sent some hummingbird photos I took last weekend. And so they got put into the newsletter.
Oh my God.
I love these little guys. Look how beautiful.
Me too. As you know, I'm a bird person.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I got to send you, I'll text you some of the photos I took last weekend.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for Jim and getting these started for us. Next one up, more pictures. This is from Andy, pronouns she and her. This is my thank you for all the positives you have brought to my life. This beauty was a regular visitor to my garden in 2018. This moment in time means so much to me as I'm having that worked into my tattoo. You all were a part of that moment, so thank you. Look at this. Is that a monarch, you think?
Wow, I don't know, but it's stunning.
So, so pretty. I love that you all are finding beauty in nature. Thank you so much for these.
Exactly. It really, really helps.
All right. Next one's yours.
This is from Barbara, no pronouns. Hello. Barbro is the Norwegian version of Barbara. Winking emoji. First, thank you for helping me understand the U.S., or maybe not understand, but at least get a better understanding. Today, I drove my mother to get her vaccination. Awesome. I assisted her inside and sat waiting with her when a nurse came and asked if we both were there to get our shots. I told her that I was just with my mother to help her, and she said, oh, good, but do you want one? Turns out someone didn't show up, and with the Pfizers, they go to waste if they're not used almost instantly. Woohoo! In Norway, the vaccination has been really slow, and latest estimates, I was scheduled to have my first shot in July.
Wow.
Wow. I'm so happy both for my mother and me. Next shot will be in May, so maybe we can actually have a summer. Also sending you Pod Pet Tax picture of one of my cats. He's the only one inside right now since they started out going out again after winter. The snow here is finally gone. Genghis, not sure if I'm pronouncing that, is 9 years and really a cuddler. Also sending pic of my happy place between the dog Sean and another of my cats, Lucy. Feel free to guess the breed.
Uh-oh. Okay.
What a cutie pie.
Oh my gosh, indeed. It looks like there's a Scotty in there or a terrier.
Chihuahua. I'm just kidding. Totally kidding.
There's probably going to be like, AG and I are like, we have to see terrier for everything and some sort of a sheepdog.
Some kind of Labrador?
Could be lab. Oh.
Oh, not
it's
even
a
close.
Poodle, Bichon, and Havanese. Am I saying that right? Havanese?
I thought that was like a sauce you put on your eggs.
I think that's Bernays, but you're close.
Oh, okay.
I think it's Havanese. Hopefully I'm not saying that wrong. AG usually is my corrector with my pronunciation, and I don't have her today, so hopefully I'm not butchering these too badly. All right. Now, this next one, several listeners wrote in to correct ID printing in Florida. Here's the one from Mac, pronounce he and him. Dearest Beans Queens, since the beginning of the pandemic, I've fallen months behind on nearly all of my other podcasts, but I've stayed current with the Beans as my first podcast of every weekday. I appreciate your intelligent and thoughtful analysis of the news and current events. Now, as a Florida resident since 2012, I wanted to comment on the role of the tax collector in Florida Motor Vehicle Administration. Driver's licensing services, vehicle registration, titling, etc., are indeed all handled by the county tax collector's office in Florida. Huh. We do not have a separate DMV MVA, so Matt Gaetz would indeed go to the tax collector's office to get a replacement government-issued ID if he were to need one. Huh. And this is just my addition. I wonder if they got printed any fake IDs for any of the women that he was traveling
with. Good question.
That's just my 2 cents. Thank you. All right, continuing. I suppose it's plausible, if sketchy as fuck, that Gaetz could meet his good buddy Joel Greenberg at the office after hours to flip through the renewed duplicate driver's licenses ordered through the online portal and waiting to be sent in the mail to pick up his. It does not, however, explain why Gaetz would leave without his replacement ID only to find the original later. Huh. It's especially gratifying when I'm playing the Beans to full volume while we work from home. My spouse asked me to pause the podcast rather than switching to headphones when he has a conference call. That's awesome. Because he wants to hear the rest when he's done. Thank you for keeping both of us informed and engaged. For Pod Pet Tax, he's our two kitties. The bronze tabby on the mantle is Atticus, who showed up on the balcony of my second floor apartment one Sunday morning demanding to be let in. When it became clear he was not feral, I left him on the balcony to get cat food and litter to care for him until I found his owner. Now, when I got back, he was off the balcony and waiting for me by my front door. That was almost 7 years ago. 2 years later, we decided he needed a friend, and I fell in love with the Torby, tortoise shell tabby, baby in the front. Now, Calliope?
Mm-hmm.
Calliope was six months old.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Good. Calliope was 6 months old when we adopted her and had been rescued after surviving alone without her mother for an indeterminate amount of time and was recovering from an abscess in her side. Oh, goodness. She was recovering from her mistrust of people, as is now the snuggliest of the two.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Look at these babies. That last picture is just a ball of fluff.
Oh, the best. Thank you for those. Awesome. This is from Mary, pronoun she, her. Thank you for continuing to present the news in an engaging, understandable way. I have heard a misheard song lyric. I once worked with a guy who insisted that the lyrics for Danger Zone went Highway Cougar Danger Zone. When pressed about what he thought that might mean, he shrugged and guessed that a cougar danger zone was similar to a deer crossing, but for dangerous feline predators.
Highway to the awesome. Danger Zone. Highway Cougar Danger Zone. All right. I love these Misheard lyrics. They make me laugh every time. Ooh, okay. So normally Amy does the Fridays with AG, and it's Amy's court. So it's you and me, Mary. We've got court today. We are holding court. This is Bean's Court is in session. Judges Protum, Dana Goldberg, and Mary Trump presiding. Now, this is from Anonymous. Anonymous brings us Wedding Bliss versus Guest Stress. Now, here it is. Hello, Beans ladies. I have a dispute that I need settled. My wedding's coming back up in September 12th, which was pushed back from last September. Yay for it actually moving forward this time. Congratulations. However, family members are in disagreement over what to put on the invitation when the time comes. First, a little background. Our list was cut from 130 to 80 people, with most starting to get vaccinated now. A lot of guests have been upfront with me over their vaccination status, and others have expressed hesitation on getting the vaccine. Sigh. Therefore, my matron of honor feels that the best path forward would be for the rule to be, quote, must show proof of vaccination or negative COVID test within 3 days of attendance. However, my mother-in-law feels that telling people that they must show proof is rude, but my matron of honor feels that this will be the only way to ensure those who are compromised can attend the wedding safely. Do you think it's out of line to ask for proof? Or should I only specifically target those who have indicated that they do not want a vaccine? For reference, this is about 4 to 5 people out of 80. Now, I need to protect those who are closest to me, and I do not want to offend my guest. My matron of honor feels no one should be surprised, but I really wanted to hear an independent, objective opinion because assertive is really hard for me, and I try to make the delicate balance between assertive and not coming off as rude. So please, please help. Thank you, ladies. Now, I think you and I are probably going to agree on this. Now, the delivery may be different. This is my take. Actually, Mary, you're the guest. You take first, and then I'll put my 2 cents in.
Yeah, I think this is a no-brainer. I'm from New York. We have lived through 13 months of absolute hell. I wouldn't go to a function, a wedding, or any other function with lots of people unless everybody was vaccinated or had negative COVID tests. We're almost through this. I honestly don't, if somebody doesn't want to get tested or feels like you're being rude, then you know what? Then they're missing out if they don't want to come. You are, by requesting this, protecting everybody there. Instead of thinking you're rude, they should love you more for it.
And boom, gavel down. I agree 100% with Mary. I would feel so much safer knowing that I was going to a wedding where people had been vaccinated. I think you'll be able to relax as the bride. This is your day. It should not be about anybody else. And I understand that you are trying not to hurt people's feelings, but I think that, and who knows if this is consistent with any other parts of your life, this is a day you get to take care of yourself. And if it makes you feel safer to have everyone vaccinated, so you know that people that are most at risk can relax and enjoy that special day, do it. You are not being rude. You are being smart, and you're being safe. So congratulations on your upcoming nuptials in September. I hope it's a beautiful day. If anyone disagrees with Mary or myself, I think that you should write in, but I don't think it's a good idea because I think we're right about this. And it's our court, and Amy can have it back next week. Oh my goodness. Okay, so we got through it. AG, I hope when you listen to this, we've at least made you a little bit proud. Thank you for trusting me with your baby. Mary, thank you for taking a break from writing your book to come on to the podcast and be my co-host today. It meant the world to me, and I always love spending time with you.
Well, thank you so much for letting me sit in your chair.
Absolutely.
Honestly, I've been looking forward to this because, like, one, I love hanging out with you. Two, it's nice to have a break, and I'm so happy I got to do good news.
Yes, it's so nice to have the good news. Before we go, AG always asks this. Any last words for our listeners, Mary?
Just what I say to everybody whenever I can. Please get vaccinated if you haven't already, and if you have, even if you're past your day of freedom, two weeks past your second shot. Keep wearing a mask. Keep social distancing. Let's keep each other safe.
I love it. And on that note, and I'm going to mess up the order, so please forgive me, but take care of yourselves, take care of the planet, take care of your mental health, and take care of each other. I've been Dana Goldberg.
I've been Mary Trump.
And them's the beans.
Refried beans. I like refried beans.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. That'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis' first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.